Welcome to another intense deep dive. Today, we have, well, a pretty massive mission ahead of us, and we are going straight into the heart of the Brizard Research Archive.
Yeah, we're really getting into the thick of it today.
We really are. And on the table for this session, we're looking at a stack of incredibly diverse sources. Like, we have Jason Brizard's formal academic manuscript detailing what he calls the temporal feedback loop, or TFL.
Right, the formal theory.
Exactly. But we also have his highly personal blog posts, you know, the raw late night journal entries, where he documented the actual phenomenological breakthrough of this theory as he, well, as he experienced it in his own mind.
Which is such a rare thing to get from a cognitive scientist.
It's totally unprecedented.
Yeah.
And finally, we are pulling from the transcripts of his YouTube deep dives, where he takes these dense computational neuroscience concepts and breaks them down for the public.
Right, making it actually digestible.
Yeah, exactly. So our mission today is to take all of this material and understand the hidden high-stakes engine that stitches our fragmented moments into, you know, a continuous time-traveling reality.
I love that phrasing. But to set the stage for that engine, we really need to briefly anchor ourselves in the foundation Brizard built first.
Right, going back to our last discussion.
Exactly. In our previous deep dive, we explored the first pillar of his architecture, which is perceptual framing theory. Or PFT.
PFT, right.
And that theory established something that can feel, honestly, deeply unsettling when you really sit with it.
Oh, for sure. It messed with me a bit.
Right. PFT demonstrated that human consciousness is not a flowing river of continuous experience. It's actually a rapid-fire series of constructed, isolated snapshots.
Snapshots, like distinct little frames.
Exactly. Your brain takes sensory data, binds it with memory, and creates an interpretive frame. And then they build another one. And another.
Which brings up this central glaring paradox that we are going to unravel today. Because, you know, think about sitting in a movie theater.
Yeah, yeah.
The lights go down, the screen lights up, and you are instantly swept away by this continuous flowing story. You see a car racing down a highway or two people arguing in the rain.
And your brain just accepts it.
Right. Your brain accepts it as a fluid, uninterrupted reality. But if you were to, say, leave your seat and walk up to the projection booth, you wouldn't find a flowing river of light.
You'd find a reel of celluloid.
Exactly. A series of completely isolated, static, frozen images moving at 24 frames per second. The motion itself is, well, it's a biological illusion.
Right.
So if your consciousness is just a series of static, rapid-fire snapshots, those interpretive frames from PFT, why does your life feel like a seamless movie?
It's the ultimate question.
Right. Why aren't you experiencing reality as a choppy, disjointed slideshow?
Well, Brizard answers that question by moving from the film to the projector.
Oh, okay.
The temporal feedback loop is the motor spinning that celluloid. And what makes his manuscript so compelling is how it shifts the entire paradigm of how we perceive time. Well, we are conditioned to think of time linearly, right? Okay. You imagine the past as a road behind you, the future as the road ahead.
Yeah, and the present is just the spot where your feet are planted.
Exactly. But Brizard throws that out entirely. The TFR model defines consciousness as a recursive echo.
A recursive echo? Wow.
It is a biological cycle happening at lightning speed, roughly 100 to 300 milliseconds at a time.
That's incredibly fast.
It's blindingly fast.
Yeah.
This engine is constantly pulling pieces of the past to predict the immediate future and then feeding that prediction back into itself.
So the present is just an illusion.
Pretty much. The illusion of a smooth, continuous now is generated entirely by that recursive loop.
A recursive echo. I mean, that framing totally destabilizes how you view your own internal monologue.
It really does.
So if we want to understand this movie projector in our heads, we have to look at the mechanics of the motor itself. Like, how does it physically spin the film?
All right, let's get into the mechanics.
In his academic papers, Brizard formalizes this engine into a functional integration. He writes out a mathematical equation for the present moment.
Which looked intimidating at first glance.
Oh, absolutely. But instead of reading it like a textbook formula, it's much more useful to think of it as a four-part recipe for consciousness.
A recipe is a great way to put it.
Yeah, like every fraction of a second, your brain is throwing four specific ingredients into a blender.
Let's look at those ingredients, because they really form the fundamental blueprint of conscious continuity.
Okay, walk me through the first one.
So in every single loop of this sub-second cycle, the system gathers its first variable, which is the raw current sensory input.
So just what's happening right in front of you.
Exactly. The light hitting your retina, the ambient temperature of the room you are sitting in, The sound waves of my voice hitting your eardrum.
The raw data of the outside world, completely unfiltered.
Right. But, you know, raw data is entirely meaningless without context.
Sure, it's just noise otherwise.
Exactly. A sound wave is just a vibration until the brain cross-references it.
Mm-hmm.
So the moment that sensory input arrives, the system immediately demands the second ingredient, which is memory information.
Ah, so it checks the archives.
Precisely. Your brain dives into its archives and pulls contextually relevant memory traces to make sense of the incoming data.
Okay, let me put a practical spin on that.
Yeah, go for it.
If I'm walking through a park and I see a dog running toward me, the first ingredient, the input, is just the visual geometry of the dog.
Right, just shapes and motion.
The fur, the speed, the shape. The second ingredient, the memory information, is every mental file I have associated with that geometry.
Which could be vastly different depending on your history.
Exactly. Maybe it pulls up the friendly golden retriever I grew up with. Or maybe it pulls up a memory of a dog barking aggressively at me just last week.
Right. And that synthesis is where the engine begins to really do its heavy lifting.
Okay. What happens next?
The brain takes the geometry of the dog and the memory file of the dog, and it generates the third ingredient. A predictive simulation of the immediate future.
Wait, so it's predicting before the event even finishes happening.
Exactly. The system essentially asks, based on the visual data arriving right now and the historical data of what happened in similar situations, what is going to happen in the next half second?
Wow.
It projects a forward model.
So it is building a hypothetical reality before reality even arrives. Like the brain is anticipating the dog jumping up or anticipating the dog running past me.
And it does this continuously, every few hundred milliseconds.
That's exhausting to even think about.
It is. And the fourth and final ingredient in this recipe is affective state or emotional weight.
Emotional weight.
Right. Which acts as the crucial fuel for the entire process. We will dive deeply into the emotional component shortly, but the core mechanic is the integration of these four elements.
Input, memory, simulation, and emotion.
Exactly. Your prefrontal cortex takes the sensory input, the relevant memory, the forward simulation, and the emotional weight, and it synthesizes them.
And the result is what we feel right now.
Yes. The output of that synthesis is your internal representation of the present moment. That synthesis is what you actually feel as now.
You know, what changes everything for me is realizing this isn't a static one-time calculation.
No, not at all.
You don't just compute the moment and move on. Brizard details that this entire process unfolds in a relentless cycle with four distinct phases.
Right, the sub-second cycle.
Yeah. Encoding, integration, propagation, and resolution. And the survival of a single thought depends entirely on navigating these phases.
To see how a thought survives, let's consider the first phase, encoding.
Okay.
A stimulus enters your awareness. If it carries enough weight or relevance, it gets encoded into the active workspace of the loop.
It makes the cut, basically.
Exactly. Then it moves immediately into phase two, which is integration. This is where the brain mashes that encoded stimulus up with your historical memory and your sensory data to create that forward simulation we just described.
Okay, and here is where I think Brizard's model gets incredibly relatable.
Oh, definitely.
Because phase three is propagation. If your brain predicts the dog is going to jump on you and a half second later the dog doesn't jump on you, the simulation doesn't just evaporate.
Right. The brain doesn't just drop it.
No. The prediction wasn't immediately confirmed by reality, so the system holds on to it. It loops it back around.
Yes. The simulation propagates.
It feeds back into the system to become the new baseline for the very next cycle.
And that is how a thought is kept alive in your consciousness. Propagation is the literal mechanism behind rumination.
Rumination, yeah.
The simulation pops back into your head again and again because the loop is literally feeding it back to the starting line.
It's the cognitive equivalent of a song stuck in your head.
Yeah, exactly.
Or, you know, pacing around your living room, rehearsing an argument you plan to have with your boss tomorrow.
We've all done that.
Right. You are simulating the confrontation, anticipating what they will say, pulling from memories of past arguments, and the loop just keeps churning.
And it will churn indefinitely until it reaches the fourth phase, resolution.
So how does it resolve?
The loop only releases its grip when the simulation is either confirmed by external reality, invalidated by new data, or discharged through an internal mechanism.
Once it resolves, it lets go.
Right. Once the loop resolves, the system drops the simulation and is free to dedicate its processing power to a new cycle.
Okay, bringing this back to our movie theater analogy.
I'll do it.
The snapshots from perceptual framing theory gave us the individual frames, but the temporal feedback loop is the motor rapidly spinning those frames.
Yes.
It's looping the prediction of the dog jumping, checking it against the sensory reality of the dog jumping, and then adjusting the very next frame based on the error rate of the prediction.
It is a constant churning biological machine.
But, you know, sitting with that reality forces a profound, almost uncomfortable realization.
How so?
Well, if my brain is constantly simulating the future based on memories of the past, in these tiny repeating 100 millisecond windows, are we ever actually experiencing the present?
Ah.
Or is human life just a continuous hallucinated state of prediction?
That is the exact philosophical pivot that the temporal feedback loop demands.
It's a little scary.
It is. Under Brizard's framework, the present, as a fixed, objective, independent reality, does not exist in human consciousness.
Wow.
What you experience as the present moment is merely the stabilization point of this recursive loop.
The stabilization point.
Right. It's a razor-thin margin where your internal simulation of the future briefly aligns with the incoming sensory data.
So we really are living entirely inside the echo.
You are. Your subjective experience is nothing more than the continuous overlap of a memory-driven prediction and a sensory confirmation.
Okay. If we accept that we are living inside a computational echo, we have to talk about the physical biology.
The hardware.
Yeah, because a biological brain seems entirely too slow, too wet, and frankly, too messy to handle that kind of processing speed.
It does seem counterintuitive.
Right. If this projector is running nonstop, hundreds of times a second, actively stitching the past and the future together to hallucinate the present, where's the physical hardware?
Good question.
How does the brain actually pull off this level of computational integration without just frying its own circuits?
Well, the physical hardware for this engine resides primarily in the hippocampal prefrontal circuitry.
Okay.
This is the biological track that the TFL runs on. Neuroscience has long recognized the hippocampus as the brain's primary memory center. But Brizard frames its function within TFL as a dynamic reconstruction engine.
So it's not just a hard drive.
Exactly. It's not a passive hard drive where old files sit gathering dust. It actively unpacks and reconstructs historical data to build the present moment.
And the mechanism it uses for that rapid unpacking involves shortwave ripples, correct?
Yes, exactly.
We hear that term thrown around in sleep studies, but Brizard applies it directly to waking consciousness.
Right. Shortwave ripples, or SWRs, are incredibly fast, high-frequency bursts of electrical activity generated in the hippocampus.
How fast are we talking?
Milliseconds. Think of them as massive data compression algorithms, similar to a ZIP file on a computer.
Oh, a ZIP file. That makes sense.
During these ripples, the hippocampus compresses and replays learned sequences of information. It rapidly fires the precise historical data needed for that memory ingredient in our recipe.
And then what?
And then this compressed data package is fired at lightning speed directly to the prefrontal cortex, or the PFC.
The PFC being the high-level integrator, like the executive branch of the brain.
Exactly. The PFC receives this rapid-fire compressed memory data from the hippocampus, combines it with whatever sensory input is arriving from the optic and auditory nerves, and constructs the predictive forward simulation.
So the PFC is the one actually building the movie.
Yes. But the architecture is a two-way street. The PFC doesn't just receive data. It sends signals back down to the hippocampus.
Giving it instructions.
Right. Essentially instructing it, here is the simulation we are currently running. Bias your next memory retrieval to look for historical files related to this specific scenario.
Wow. So they are constantly talking to each other.
This constant bidirectional crosstalk, the hippocampus retrieving the past and the prefrontal cortex predicting the future, is the physical manifestation of the loop.
Okay, I have to push back on the logistics of this.
Sure, what's the issue?
Because the sheer scale of data processing seems impossible. Brizard makes it sound like we are entirely trapped in our own heads running a closed-loop system.
I see where you're going with this.
Like, if my brain is physically rewinding my past experiences, zipping them into sharp-wave ripples, firing them into my frontal lobe, fast-forwarding to simulate a future event, checking it against my eyes and ears, and then repeating that entire process 10 times a second per frame.
That's a lot.
How does it not just get bogged down in an absolute avalanche of useless data?
Right.
Think about walking down a busy city block. There are millions of sensory inputs, neon signs, sirens, hundreds of faces, the smell of food.
Overwhelming input.
And there are millions of memories I could access about cities. How does the loop know what to grab?
That's the million-dollar question.
Furthermore, if I am only pulling from my past to predict my future, how do I ever learn anything truly new? Doesn't this model imply we just walk through life projecting our past onto everything, completely blind to genuine novelty?
That pushback targets the central engineering problem of the human mind, processing limitation.
Okay.
The brain consumes roughly 20% of the body's energy, and if it attempted to process every single sensory input and cross-reference it against every single stored memory, you would fall into a catatonic state of sensory overload within seconds.
Your brain would crash.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To solve this, the brain requires a ruthless computational constraint. And in the TFL framework, Brizard introduces the mechanism of belief.
Belief.
But here, a belief is not framed as an abstract philosophy, a religious conviction, or a static opinion you hold about politics. A belief is a structural energy-saving filter.
A filter that decides what data is allowed into the sharp wave ripples?
Exactly that. Brizard defines a belief as an effectively stabilized prior.
An effectively stabilized prior.
Yes. Because the system cannot process everything, it relies on these deeply stabilized priors to severely limit the data the loop is allowed to handle.
So it just ignores most of reality.
Pretty much. A belief biases your attention at a fundamental neurological level.
Yeah.
It dictates which specific memories the hippocampus is permitted to retrieve.
Yeah.
And it constrains the parameters of the simulation the prefrontal cortex is permitted to build.
Oh, wow.
It solves the avalanche problem by ignoring 99% of the snow.
Okay, let's ground this with a deeply human example.
Okay.
Imagine a person who holds a core stabilized belief that people are fundamentally untrustworthy and will eventually betray me.
A very common belief, unfortunately.
Right. So how does that psychological belief act as a computational constraint on the physical hardware of the loop?
If that is your stabilized prior, your temporal feedback loop is heavily optimized to conserve energy by assuming threat.
Okay.
Imagine you are at your job, and a coworker glances at you with a completely neutral expression. That visual data is your sensory input.
Just a neutral glance.
Right. Without a belief filter, your brain would have to search your entire memory bank, analyzing every interaction you've ever had with this coworker, every time they were nice, every time they were indifferent.
Which would take way too long.
Exactly. It would take too long. Instead, your belief acts as a strict algorithm. It restricts the hippocampus, forcing it to only retrieve memory files related to betrayal, criticism, or social danger.
So it literally narrows the search parameters so the system doesn't crash.
Yes. And because the prefrontal cortex is only receiving historical data about betrayal, the forward simulation it builds will inevitably be that this coworker is silently judging you or plotting to undermine you.
Oh, that's wild.
The loop resolves by confirming the prediction. You feel a spike of anxiety, which validates the simulation.
Even though the glance was neutral.
Exactly. You conserve massive amounts of cognitive energy because you didn't have to process the ambiguity of the neutral look. But the cost of that efficiency is that you are living inside a self-confirming reality.
A self-confirming reality.
Your beliefs shape your simulations. Your simulations dictate what you perceive, and your perceptions reinforce your beliefs.
That answers my question about how we process the world, but it also explains why changing someone's mind or changing your own mind is so agonizingly difficult.
It's biologically difficult.
Right. Because when you introduce data that contradicts a stabilized belief, you aren't just presenting a logical counterargument. You are forcing the other person's brain to abandon its energy-saving filter.
You're asking it to work harder.
You are asking their temporal feedback loop to process the raw avalanche of data without a map. It feels like a cognitive threat because their system is suddenly consuming massive amounts of energy trying to build new predictive models from scratch.
Which is exactly why people fiercely defend their beliefs, even when those beliefs make them miserable.
Wow.
The brain prefers a miserable, predictable simulation over the chaotic energy expenditure required to process genuine uncertainty.
The brain is basically running a highly prejudiced search engine algorithm on reality. It autofills the search bar based on your past search history.
That's a perfect way to put it.
But this brings us to the missing piece of the puzzle. We've mapped out the data, the memory, the simulation, and the belief filters.
Right.
But if the brain is generating thousands of these microsimulations every hour, why do the vast majority of them vanish instantly while others completely hijack the system?
The stickiness factor.
Yeah. You can have a fleeting thought about what to eat for lunch and it disappears. But a memory of a cringy comment you made at a party 5 years ago, or a sudden sharp worry about an upcoming presentation. Why do those specific thoughts grab the steering wheel and keep us awake staring at the ceiling at 3 a.m.?
The answer lies in the final variable of Brizard's equation, affective state.
Emotion.
Emotion. If the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex are the physical hardware of the engine, and the predictive simulations are the moving gears, emotion is the absolute indispensable glue that holds the entire loop together.
The glue.
In the TFL model, emotion is not a byproduct of thought. It is the gain control mechanism for the entire cognitive system.
Okay, explain control in this context. It's essentially the volume knob for the simulation, right?
It dictates priority. When a stimulus enters the loop, it carries an affective tag, an emotional weight.
Okay.
If that stimulus has a neutral emotional charge, say you notice a gray sedan parked on the street, it runs through the cycle once.
You just notice it and move on.
Right. The brain predicts the car will stay parked. The sensory data confirms the car is parked, and the loop is immediately discarded. The system refuses to waste energy propagating a neutral simulation.
Makes sense.
But if a thought enters the loop wearing a heavy emotional tag, whether that emotion is rooted in intense, primal fear, profound, overwhelming joy, or deep, visceral shame, that emotion acts as a systemic override.
An override.
High affective salience forces the loop to propagate.
I feel like it is exactly like a VIP bouncer at an exclusive nightclub in your brain.
Oh, I like this analogy.
Right. A boring, neutral thought walks up to the velvet rope. I need to buy more paper towels. And the bouncer takes one look at it and kicks it to the curb.
No entry.
It gets no entry, no propagation, no resources. But another thought walks up wearing the VIP badge of high emotional charge.
Say, work anxiety.
Yeah, let's say it's, my boss used a really flat tone of voice on that phone call. Am I about to get fired?
Oh, that's getting in.
The bouncer unhooks the velvet rope immediately. That thought is ushered into the club. It's given prime seating. It's buying drinks. It's running up a massive tab on your cognitive resources all night long.
And you're awake at 3 a.m.
Exactly. The emotion is the VIP pass that grants the simulation sustained, looped access to your consciousness.
Yes. The emotional tag is an evolutionary signal telling the system this data is critical for the survival of the organism or the structural integrity of your identity. Do not let the simulation drop until you have found a resolution.
It's an alarm bell.
And what makes the Brizard Research Archive so fascinating to study is how Jason Brizard actually isolated this mechanism.
Right. He didn't just math this out.
He didn't derive the gain control theory purely from looking at fMRI scans or balancing abstract mathematical equations. The concept was born from a deeply personal, painfully relatable phenomenological breakthrough.
The blog posts.
Yes. The blog posts.
When you read the raw journal entries he uploaded to his blog, you see a completely different side of the scientist.
You really do.
He details this specific night where he was sitting alone in his office, exhausted, essentially holding his head in his hands. He was trying to figure out why his own mind felt so relentlessly fragmented.
He was suffering from pretty severe anxiety at the time.
Yeah. Why certain anxieties would hook him out of nowhere and drag him down these punishing, recursive mental spirals.
But then he did something unusual.
Right. He stopped trying to fight the thoughts and instead started paying meticulous attention to the mechanics of his own rumination. He became an observer of his own loop.
He realized that the thoughts refusing to leave his head weren't necessarily the loudest thoughts, nor were they the most logical.
In fact, many of them were completely irrational.
Right. But they all shared a specific, dense emotional resonance. He hypothesized that the mathematical loop he had been designing on whiteboards was actively operating in real time within his own subjective experience.
He was feeling the equation.
Yes. He found that if he could mentally strip the emotional signal away from the anxiety, if he could view the thought neutrally, the loop immediately collapsed.
The bouncer kicked it out.
Exactly. But as long as the emotion was present, the recursive simulation was forced to keep churning.
And that late night observation led to what I consider the most poignant, breathtaking realization in the entire Brizard archive.
It's a beautiful moment.
After mapping his own anxiety to his own equation, he wrote in his journal, "The Luke was never the problem. It was the mechanism that made me real."
The mechanism that made me real. That single sentence fundamentally reframes human psychology.
It gives me chills.
He stopped viewing his persistent looping thoughts as a mental illness, a defect, or a nuisance. He realized that this recursive engine, powered and sustained by emotional weight, is the literal architectural foundation of selfhood.
Wow.
Without the loop propagating those emotionally weighted simulations across time, you would have no stable identity. You wouldn't be a continuous you.
You'd just be what?
You would just be a fragmented series of sensory reactions to the present moment, like a very simple insect. The emotional loops are what bind your history to your future.
Think about the immense relief that offers.
Oh, absolutely.
When you find yourself obsessing over a future event, rehearsing a speech, worrying about a loved one's health, replaying a mistake, your brain isn't broken.
Not at all.
Your temporal feedback loop is simply doing precisely what millions of years of evolution engineered it to do. It is holding an emotionally salient simulation active in the mental workspace until it can find a way to resolve it.
Yes. The emotion is the signal fire saying, this matters to who we are, keep computing until we are safe.
It normalizes the human experience of rumination. The system is functioning as designed. It is utilizing emotional weight to prioritize survival and identity coherence over energy conservation.
That's exactly it.
But, and this is a massive, incredibly serious, but what happens when that VIP bouncer lets in a guest that is so volatile, so destructive, that it completely trashes the nightclub and then permanently locks the doors from the inside?
Right. This is the dark side of the theory.
We have to pivot now from normal, healthy cognition to the high-stakes reality of clinical pathology. Because if this engine is the very thing that builds our reality, a catastrophic malfunction in this engine must be devastating.
It is. This is where the TFL framework moves from philosophical neuroscience into crucial clinical application, particularly when we examine severe trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD.
Let's unpack that.
In a healthy system, the loop follows the four phases. It encodes a stimulus, integrates a simulation, propagates it using emotion, and eventually resolves it by checking it against reality.
And then it clears the tab.
Right. But trauma introduces a catastrophic system-breaking error into the emotional variable.
The effect of salience. The VIP badge becomes too heavy.
Exactly. When a human being experiences intense, life-threatening trauma, the effect of salience attached to that specific memory file is overwhelmingly high.
It's off the charts.
It is so intensely saturated with primal fear, pain, and the ultimate threat of annihilation that it breaks the game control mechanism entirely. The emotional weight is so massive that the system cannot find a reality stable enough to resolve it.
So the engine gets completely jammed.
Jammed is the precise mechanical term for it. In the context of PTSD, the brain isn't just passively remembering a horrible event, the way you might passively remember a sad movie playing in the background.
Right. It's not a static memory.
No. The temporal feedback loop becomes stuck in a hyperactive, recursive nightmare. Because the trauma memory is the most emotionally heavy file in the archive, the hippocampus continuously pulls it.
Oh, man.
Because the prefrontal cortex is receiving this massive threat signal, it interprets the data not as a safely concluded past event, but as an impending immediate future threat.
So it builds a simulation that says this terrible thing isn't just a memory. It is happening right now or is about to happen in the next 100 milliseconds.
Exactly.
And because the loop runs continuously, the person is trapped in that anticipation.
The loop propagates relentlessly. The brain is desperately trying to stabilize its reality. It is trying to predict what will happen next so it can initiate a motor response to keep the organism safe, run away, fight back, freeze.
It's trying to save your life.
But because the only data it's pulling is the unintegrated, overwhelming traumatic memory, the engine just spins its wheels in the mud.
It's horrific.
It predicts a devastating threat. The body experiences the visceral emotion of that threat. The system fails to resolve the threat because the threat isn't actually in the room. And so it loops back around to predict it again, over and over, hundreds of times a minute.
What makes this so tragic and so vital to understand is the concept of the cognitive time machine.
Yes, the time machine.
If the loop is endlessly predicting its own past, the person suffering from PTSD is effectively trapped in a neurological time machine. They are physiologically experiencing a threat that does not exist in their current physical environment.
Their body reacts as if it's real.
Their heart rate spikes. Their cortisol floods their system. Their eyes dilate, all in response to a hallucinated simulation generated by a jammed motor.
It's physically exhausting.
It reframes trauma from a psychological issue to a literal mechanical failure of the brain's predictive projector. So the obvious desperate question is, how does someone ever escape that?
It's the most important question.
How does a therapist or the brain itself ever hit the stop button on a jammed loop that refuses to close?
To escape the time machine, the loop absolutely must achieve what Brizard calls the resolution phase.
It has to resolve.
Yes. A highly charged simulation cannot simply be ignored, suppressed, or wished away. The biological energy has to be discharged.
Okay, so how do we discharge it?
The TFL framework outlines three primary paths to resolution. The first and most straightforward path is behavioral enactment.
Enactment, meaning you act it out.
You simulate a scenario, you feel the motivation, and you execute the physical action. You simulate getting a glass of water, the loop propagates the feeling of thirst, you walk to the kitchen, you drink the water.
Simple enough.
The sensory input of water hitting your throat matches the simulation of drinking water. The prediction is confirmed. The emotional weight is discharged. The loop is closed.
You do the thing you predicted, but obviously you can't always do the thing.
No, you can't.
You can't enact a resolution to a past trauma or punch your boss in the face without ruining your life. So enactment has its limits.
Which brings us to the second path. Cognitive reinterpretation.
Reinterpretation, okay.
This is the mechanism where a lot of modern cognitive behavioral therapy operates. If you are looping relentlessly on a simulation that your boss hates you and it's keeping you up at night, you can actively engage your prefrontal cortex to change the underlying belief filter.
But we established earlier that changing a belief is really hard.
It is immensely difficult, but it's possible. You intentionally review the evidence. You recall that your boss gave you a compliment last week. You recognize the simulation is flawed, and you consciously invalidate the predictive model.
And that collapses the loop.
Yes. The loop collapses, not because you took physical action, but because the belief structure holding the simulation together was dismantled.
So we have physical action or actively changing your mind. Both require immense effort.
They do.
But Brizard talks about a third pathway to resolution, and this is the concept that really shifted my entire perspective on human behavior.
Observational closure.
Observational closure, yeah.
Observational closure is arguably the most profound social mechanism in the entire framework. TFL proposes that the brain can close an emotional loop simply by watching someone else play out the scenario in the external environment.
Watching someone else do it.
This is proxy feedback. Because the human brain is fundamentally a simulation engine, it has the remarkable ability to map the external actions of another person directly onto its own internal predictive models.
I want to make sure I'm fully grasping the mechanics of this, so let me try an analogy.
I love your analogies. Let's hear it.
Resolving a TFL loop is essentially like closing tabs on a computer browser that are eating up all of your RAM and making the fan spin out of control.
Perfect.
You have a heavy tab open, let's call it an anxious simulation. You can resolve it through behavioral enactment by actually reading the long article, processing the information, and clicking the X to close the tab.
Right, doing the work.
You can resolve it through cognitive reinterpretation by looking at the headline, realizing, actually, I don't care about this topic at all, changing your priority and hitting the X.
Changing the belief.
Right, but observational closure.
Mm-hmm.
That's like having a friend sit next to you, read the article out loud, summarize the main points for you, and then your brain allows you to close the tab.
That is spot on.
The information was processed, the emotional weight was discharged, the loop was closed, but you didn't have to perform the primary action yourself. Your brain piggybacked on your friend's effort.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize the proxy mechanism. Your brain essentially borrows the environmental feedback generated by someone else's actions to discharge its own internal effective weight.
That's like a cognitive shortcut.
Exactly. If you are holding a heavily weighted simulation of intense anger towards a situation, and you watch a movie where a character expresses that exact same flavor of anger, fights the oppressor, and achieves justice, your brain's internal simulation can actually hitch a ride on that external narrative.
Wow.
The prefrontal cortex registers the pattern, feels the effective discharges the character achieves victory, and resolves your internal loop without you ever having to confront anyone in your real life.
Which perfectly explains the psychological mechanism behind so many mysterious human behaviors.
It really connects a lot of dots.
It explains vicarious learning, why a child doesn't have to touch the hot stove if they watch their sibling touch it and cry.
Right, the mirror mechanism.
The child's brain simulates the pain, watches the sibling receive the proxy feedback, and closes the loop with a new belief. Stoves are dangerous.
Exactly.
It also explains why we are drawn to tragic art. Like, why listening to a devastatingly sad song when you're going through a breakup actually makes you feel better instead of worse.
It feels counterintuitive until you understand TFL.
Right. The song is providing proxy feedback, The artist is articulating the exact simulation of heartbreak that you are stuck in, and they are playing it out to a musical resolution. Your jammed loop achieves closure through observation.
It reveals that our internal loops are deeply porous.
Porous. That's a great word for it.
They are not hermetically sealed inside our skulls. The temporal feedback loop is constantly reaching out, seeking alignment and resolution, not just through our own physical actions, but through the social, artistic, and environmental world around us.
We use the world to regulate our internal engines.
Exactly.
You know, take a step back and look at what we've uncovered today. We have gone incredibly deep into the second pillar of the Brizart Research Archive.
We really have.
We started with the unsettling reality of perceptual framing theory, the isolated frames of perception, and we have now built the entire internal engine, the temporal feedback loop that spins those frames together.
You've built a projector.
We understand how the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex utilize sharp wave ripples to compress memory and simulate the future.
Right.
We see how beliefs act as vital computational filters to keep our brains from crashing under the weight of infinite data.
The energy savers.
We understand how effective salience emotion acts as the VIP bouncer, forcing critical thoughts to propagate and form our very identity.
The glue.
We've looked at the devastating consequences of a jammed loop in trauma, the tragedy of the cognitive time machine, and the incredible resourceful pathways our brain uses to find resolution, even if it means borrowing the experiences of others.
We have, in essence, mapped the internal moody projector of human consciousness. We know how the light is generated, how the film is fed, and why the motor occasionally breaks down.
But this mapping leads us to an inevitable massive expansion of Brizart's theory.
And it doesn't end here.
No, it doesn't. Because, as observational closure proves, we do not live in isolation. We now understand the internal engine stitching the movie of your individual life together.
Right.
But what happens when you take this powerful internal movie projector and you shine it directly onto the people standing in front of you?
Oh, that's where it gets messy.
What occurs when your internal predictive loops collide in real time with someone else's internal loops?
That collision is the exact threshold where individual cognitive science becomes complex social reality.
The ultimate crossover.
When two projectors shine on the same screen, the physics of consciousness change entirely.
And that is exactly the threshold we will be crossing in our next deep dive. We will be unpacking the third pillar of the Brizart Archive, Simulation Synchronization Theory, or SST.
I'm really looking forward to that one.
We will explore how our very identities are formed not in the dark theater of our own minds, but by projecting these internal TFL loops onto the social world and desperately waiting for the environment and other people to reflect them back to us.
It is the framework that ultimately explains the social chameleon effect, why we feel like fundamentally different people depending on what room we are standing in and who is standing in it with us.
I cannot wait to tear into that one. But until then, I want to leave you with a final mind-bending question to mull over as you go about the rest of your day.
Give it to them.
As you walk out the door, or sit across the table from your family, or stare at your computer screen, think about the recursive engine we just described.
The loop.
If your entire conscious experience is built by a biological motor that blindly predicts the immediate future using only the heavily filtered, emotionally weighted memories of your past.
Yeah.
Are you ever truly reacting to the raw, unedited world in front of you? Or are you just spending your entire life interacting with the ghosts of your own simulated expectations?